Welcome to Bull Market Thinking. I'm your host, Dakota Da Silva. With us here on the line is Mark Faber, publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. Mark, getting right into it, I remember back in late 2008, you're one of the only guys in the world that came out and said that you thought gold exploration companies were one of the best speculations at that period. And that ended up being the case, with many moving up 10 to 20 fold after that time. So I got to ask you here, what are your thoughts when you look at the mining as well as the exploration sector for resources? Because it looks like it's gone from gloom to boom to, of course, now doom. So what are your thoughts there?
Yes. Being on the board of some exploration companies, I'm well aware of the problems in the industry. And I think that the investors who buy physical gold like I do and people who buy exploration companies are two different types of investors. The physical gold buyers, they buy it largely as an insurance, as a currency that cannot be multiplied the way paper monies can be multiplied. The exploration people and the investors, they basically are high risk takers, because the problem with exploration companies, and I'm talking here specifically about exploration companies and not the producing companies, the exploration companies, they have no cash flow. In other words, they are buying concessions or have these concessions, then they're drilling, then they have to make a feasibility study, and then they have to raise money to develop the mines. And this is a very time-consuming and risky proposition. And when the mood, as has happened over the last, say, 12 to 18 months, turns negative about gold and about gold mining shares, they get slaughtered and they cannot raise any money. It's very difficult at the present time for exploration companies to raise any money. So my thought at the present time is this. Of course, they will move along with the gold price. We had a very serious decline in gold prices, and a technician would say that gold has broken down, which is it has. I mean, we have to face the reality. But we had other markets that broke down, like the U.S. stock market and global markets in 87, and subsequently they recovered. Or gold broke down between 1974 and 1976, and then it went up another eight times. So I would say, if someone is really very bullish and optimistic about gold prices going up in future, at the present time, there is actually a lot of value in exploration companies.
Yeah. Mark, you've also made some comments about the general equities market of really beginning to become overbought here, creating the risk of another volatile collapse. So when you look at, again, when you look at gold, do you see it maybe having a drag down if the general equities markets goes into a sharp downturn? Will gold be stuck within this sideways consolidation for a longer period, do you think?
It's very difficult to tell. First of all, I mean, I always pay attention to big market moves. And as soon as big market moves occur, I'm asking myself, why did they occur? Now, I'm aware that some people believe that the gold market was manipulated down. I have no proof of it having happened, but it could very well have happened. I just don't see why anyone would really want to depress the gold market, because say Western central banks, they still own the bulk of gold in the world. And they are well aware that with their large reserves, central banks in emerging economies, notably in Asia, are grossly underweight gold. So why would they depress the price of gold in order to kind of make a gift to the Asian central banks to be able to buy gold at a lower price? That I don't see entirely. But I think maybe what has happened, the collapse in gold prices recently, and the very strong performance in U.S. treasuries, which over the last 6 weeks have grossly outperformed U.S. stocks, is signaling that something of a deflationary shock, despite of all the money printing, is still a possibility.
Yeah.
But in that case, I would say if you had a deflationary shock, about the last thing you should own are paper assets, notably equities, because corporate profits would also come under pressure. But I think if the market collapsed, personally, if the market collapsed, I think physical gold may be the place to be, relatively speaking. I'm not so sure about the gold shares if the market collapsed.
Yeah. So, Mark, when we look at gold and compared to paper currencies around the world, a lot of our listeners, maybe some of them are frustrated with the amount of time that it takes for the repricing to occur. And so what are your thoughts when you think about this in terms of the total amount of money that's been created? Do you see some kind of a major shock of a repricing in gold, or do you see a gradual type of, maybe over the course of a decade, gold slowly finds its price in comparison to the monetization and created by the central banks? What are your thoughts there?
Well, first of all, say if you look at 1999 or 2000 up to 2011, 2012, then you have to say that gold and silver and copper and oil significantly outperformed financial assets. And that maybe, I'm not saying that is necessarily the case, but maybe by increasing from around $250 an ounce to, at the peak, $1,921 an ounce, gold has already discounted a lot of money printing. I don't think that the bull market is over, personally. And I have mentioned repeatedly that I'm still buying gold and that I will never sell my gold. But I think the problem with investors is that they always buy assets after they have moved substantially, and then they go crazy and put too much money instead of continuously applying a disciplined investment strategy that implies diversification between real estate, cash and bonds, gold and equities. And I mean, I get a lot of emails from people about gold, and my sense is that some people have like 80 to 90% of their money in gold. And so when it goes down, they are hurt and they are worrying. But if you have a diversified portfolio of bonds and cash and equities and real estate, actually, in principle, you wouldn't want to have the gold price being too strong, because it would mean that something is terribly wrong in the system.
Yeah. You know, Mark, I saw a fascinating conversation that you had with Jim Rogers. It was recorded sometime around 2004, and the subject of terrorism came up. And Jim said to you, he said, what do I do? Do I leave New York? Where do I go? To Boston? To London? These places are at risk, and that's exactly what has happened, of course, with London, New York, and now Boston. So you had some interesting thoughts that I saw recorded at that time on the subject of terrorism. And I want to ask you here, when you think about it, is this something that's going to continue to grow? What are your thoughts when you think about that concept?
Well, I think we have to realize that every action creates a reaction. And the U.S. and the Western countries of Europe, they go into Libya and they remove a leader that had improved over time and done not a perfect job, but a reasonably good job compared to a lot of other leaders in the world, including leaders of European countries, I may add, and the U.S., by the way. And they go into Afghanistan and Iraq and launched drone attacks in Pakistan and so forth and so on. Now put yourself into the shoes of someone who grows up in a family that is not a terrorist, and suddenly a drone hits your house and your parents die or your children die and so forth. That breeds every day one new terrorist. That man who's seen being attacked by a drone, an innocent bystander, basically will vow revenge. And so the more you attack these people with artificial weapons, where it's no longer a war, man against man on the battlefield, but technology, these people then apply also dirty methods. And what we'll see increasingly are acts of terrorism, but the much worse terrorism will be maybe cyber attacks, where you target, say, the control tower of an airport, and you just shut down the entire airport because the air control tower no longer functions. Or you shut down the electricity or the traffic lights of a city, and so forth and so on. So I think that maybe if security and your personal safety is an issue, you'll be better off in the countryside.
Yeah. Mark, when I was a young teenager, I visited Brazil for the first time, shortly afterwards Thailand. And I'm back in Brazil now. This is about 10, 15 years later. And it's no longer cheap. The world doesn't seem cheap anymore like it did to me back in 2001. It was so exciting, especially as a U.S. dollar-denominated tourist. So when you travel the world today, is the world just no longer cheap, or is it no longer cheap to the U.S. dollar tourists? And do you see it getting back to a place where things are cheap and exciting again, I guess, for prospective speculators and this kind of thing?
Well, it's a very good issue that you're raising. Basically, we had a colossal depreciation in the purchasing power of paper monies. And that is basically inflation. When you say, when I travel in the 90s or mid-90s, the world was cheap, well, I can tell you, I've been in Asia since 1973, and some cities in Asia have become extremely expensive, like Singapore, Hong Kong, high-end properties in these places, and so forth. Or even Spain. When I first went to Spain, we were students. We didn't have a lot of money, so we went to Spain because everything was inexpensive. Now everything is relatively expensive. So yes, you're right. Basically, the money printing by the U.S. hasn't created dramatic consumer price inflation in the U.S., but more inflation than what the government is publishing, that for sure. Because the cost of living have also gone up substantially in the U.S. But everywhere you go around the world, the inflowing liquidity has essentially boosted prices, and you're right, it's no longer that cheap.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have to say Thailand is still, and I'm sure also in Brazil, in some cities, life is still reasonably or far more a bargain than, say, in Western Europe and the U.S. And then we would have to define, in Thailand, you may stay at a hotel, high-end luxury, and it will cost you maybe $1,500 a night in a villa. And you can stay in a small hotel for maybe $50 a night or maybe $20 a night. So there's a huge divergence in prices between high-end and low-end. You can eat on the street in Thailand for, say, $1 or $2, perfectly good food. You can go next door to a restaurant, high-end, and you spend $100, $150 for a dinner. But I agree with you. We had a huge price increases. That's why when people tell me we are in deflation, well, certainly hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Still on that same topic of when you look back at history, some of the most exciting times as an investment buyer during your career, what are the type of conditions that you look for? Is it absolute panic? Is it complete depression of asset prices in terms of the best markets a person can find? Do you expect that we will see those conditions again here in the not-too-distant future?
Well, I mean, I think that markets always move up and down. And there will always be opportunities. If I had the time, I would probably look now at some assets in Eastern Europe because the markets have been totally slammed and these markets are very depressed at the present time. I just don't have the time to go there. And I don't think I would want to make an investment large enough to have a meaningful impact on my portfolio. But I think there are always opportunities. Every bubble eventually bursts, like the U.S. housing bubble. So 18 months ago, home prices in the U.S. became very cheap. I don't think they're that cheap anymore because the hedge fund guys and the private equity people came in and bought all the homes and pushed up the price. But 18 months ago, there was a window of opportunity as well as with home building stocks. This is probably gone. And so I believe again and again there will be opportunities. 2008, 2009, there was a great opportunity in Thailand. Stocks were selling, I don't know, at less than 10 times earnings. Some maybe at 6 times earnings, dividend yields of 6-7%, and so forth. Now they're up 4 times from the lows. I don't think there's a great opportunity now to buy Thai stocks, but I believe there will be again an opportunity because I'm sure that the present government, after creating a huge boom, will screw it up very badly.
Yeah. Mark, as a final question for you, Bill Gross published a piece yesterday which he spoke about inevitable haircuts in the banking system. And he used the word haircuts as a nice word for saying confiscation, devaluations, collapses, and so forth. And so I want to ask you, when you saw what happened there in Cyprus, and then when we see some of these Latin American countries, Venezuela, Argentina, and so forth, of you shut down the bank, you devalue the currency, or you take away the depositors' money, do you think this is really setting a sign for what's to come for something much bigger globally down the road?
Yes, I think the problem is this. We have, as a result of Federal Reserve's monetary policies, and other central banks' money printing created a huge wealth and income inequality. So you have, say, and I'm not saying that 1% is the right figure. It could be 0.5% or 0.25%. It could be 5%. Say you have 1% of the people in a system like the U.S. that benefited incredibly from rising asset prices, stocks and real estate, bonds, paintings, high-end properties. Hampton properties are up 35% over the last 12 months. These are high-end properties. So when you print money, the money doesn't flow evenly into the system, but the people closest to the source of the money, with the financial sector, they benefit the most. And so you create essentially a lot of people who are very dissatisfied and they have the same vote than the 1%, except they're 99%. So how do you think they will vote? Eventually, to them, it will be very acceptable to take money away from the 1%. And the leader like Mr. Obama, he knows how to use that. He's not buying votes the Asian way, which is giving out money in a brown envelope to voters. But he's doing it with food stamps, disability insurance, all kinds of social programs, and so forth and so on. And all these people, and these are about half the U.S. households, have a member that gets some kind of benefit from the government. all these people, they don't want anyone like the Republicans to come in and cut them down. They want these programs to continue. And the Republicans, in a way, they say, okay, we don't like it, but as long as they print money, our assets are going up. But in the end, something will happen. And I am much more concerned about what will happen to people that have assets, including myself, than whether gold goes up or gold goes down, or stocks go up and stocks go down, and bonds go up and bonds go down. That you can essentially, by being diversified, live with. We always had volatility in markets. We never knew exactly where markets would head to and so forth. That I can live with. But what I really would hate is that one day the government comes and says, okay, we're going to take 50% of your money and give it to social programs or to government officials that are useless. But I think this is a real threat. This is a real threat. Less so in Asia, but more so in the Western world, under the democracies we have in the Western world and in the US. And I can see in American politics, you have now some kind of class warfare, in the sense that whatever goes wrong, you blame someone. You blame mostly well-to-do people. And it's easy target. You tell the majority of people, you know why you have no jobs? You know why your salaries are going down in real terms? Because these rich guys are taking it away from you. No, the rich guys haven't been taking it away from them. But they knew, and because they had the assets, they were the beneficiaries of money printing. But of course, the Obama type of leaders will never go and blame fiscal deficits and central banks for the rise in wealth and income inequality.
You know, Mark, I remember there being a pretty fascinating painting that you have on your website. I forgot the name of it, but it depicts the story of a skeleton. And if I remember it correctly, it's watching the same story or the same cycle occur over and over again. If I got that right, do you sit back and carry amusement at this point with watching this all play out?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm 67, so I hope I don't have to see all the disasters. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I'm very, very bearish about the trend the world has embarked upon, A, in terms of social conditions in the Western world, the wealth inequality, money printing. I mean, it's absurd to think that you can create economic growth by boosting asset prices. Now, you have to be an academic that never worked in the private sector, never produced anything to believe a nonsense like that. But that is precisely what the Western central bankers, in particular Greenspan, Bernanke, and this kind of crowd believes. Number two, I think we have a rise of, say, new countries in the world, whether that is India or China or Russia. These were not participants in the global economy to a meaningful share until, say, 20 years ago. But now they have become important and they want to have more say in global affairs. In the meantime, the share of in global GDP of Europe and the US is shrinking, including their geopolitical clout. So whereas 100 or 200 years ago, the Western countries could walk over essentially Africa and rob them and expropriate them and abuse them, that they can't do anymore. They don't have the manpower. And so you have a new world order that creates increasing tensions. Now you take, say, the U.S. I believe if the U.S. was not in Asia, the Asian countries could live with China and they could make kind of agreements with China about border disputes and so forth. But But this is not the desire of the U.S. and the Western power. The Western powers, they want to stir up the tensions between India and China. Ideally, they would love to see a war between these various factions in the world so that they can sell them weapons and make a lot of money out of weapons and weaken these countries' economic and political rise. So we have a very dangerous world, and I'm not sure what the outcome will be, but I believe that in 20 to 30 years, we'll have a very different world than what we had until, say, 10 years ago, where the Western democracies were the dominant economic and political powers of the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating to think about. Mark, I know that your time is running short here, so in winding down, I want to thank you so much. Mark Faber, publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, thank you for sharing your comments with us.
Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye.